Welcome to the Martian Driving Podcast 26. My name is Terry Frost, and this time around we're going to look at two different films. We're going from arachnids to AI, starting off with the 1955 giant spider movie Tarantula, starring John Agar and Mara Corday, and then zip panning to the 21st century to have a look at Her, the Spike Jones movie, starring Joaquin Phoenix, Amy Adams, and the voice of Scarlett Johansson. So sit back, relax, and we will get this thing started for you.
The Martian Driving Podcast is a fortnightly look at science fiction, fantasy, and horror films. New or old, it does not matter. What matters is that we like them and we find them interesting. Feedback is our soil and green, so you can email it to cultguru@gmail.com. You can go over to the Paleo Cinema Cafe on Facebook and drop a note. You can leave a message at marsdrivein.blogspot.com, or put your dulcet tones into a voicemail at the new number, write it down, 206-337-5398. Occasionally there'll be adult concepts discussed, so this podcast can be explicit. And I would like to send a shout out to the NSA, GCHQ, and the Australian Signals Directorate. I hope you enjoy the shows, you mongrels.
How is everybody? This is the first of the Martian Driving Podcast I've recorded for 2014. And since I recorded the last one, things have gone weird. The weather in the Northern Hemisphere went totally weirdly and distressingly Roland Emmerich with the polar vortex, which sounds like a Sci-Fi Channel movie, but obviously wasn't. And then down here in Melbourne, we got 4 days in a row above 40 degrees. In fact, it got up to 46 degrees centigrade, which is about 112 old school for a little while. So, yeah, the weather has gone weird. And because there's nothing more boring than talking about the weather, I'm going to change the subject now. Things here are okay. My throat's still a little bit bad. It's not sore, but it sounds croaky. So if I sound a little bit different, that's the reason why, and I do apologise, but the show must go on. This time around, we're looking at a couple of interesting films. We're doing Tarantula, of course, from 1955. Giant monsters are always a bit of fun, and I thought I'd revisit one that's interesting. I was going to do them, but I'm going to save them to another podcast, because the giant ant thing definitely is something that I should cover. But I'll do it later. And then, of course, I'll do a totally modern film, which is only now being released in the cinemas in Australia, which is Her from 2013, directed by and written by Spike Jones, not the Spike Jones who had the City Slickers and did all sorts of groovy novelty songs in the 1940s, but the new Spike Jones with the Z-E on the end, who's done some interesting things and has done something even more interesting with Her. I've seen a couple of comments about it on the internet, which are a little bit derogatory, but I'll go into that just a little bit more later. So what have I been watching? A fair bit, because I've been slightly under the weather with this throat, which gives me a sexy Scarlett Johansson-y croak about it. What kind of genre films have I watched this year? I've left Mizzo off. Mizzo seems to be going a little bit cranky, so I've gone to Letterboxd. So if you go to Letterboxd and follow me as Paleo Cinema, one word with no dash, you'll see the list of movies that I've watched in 2014, and there have been a number of genre films amongst them. Let me see. After doing Scanners last fortnight, I watched Scanners 2 and Scanners 3, which were lesser films, to be honest with you. Not as great as the first one, of course, but watching them was a little bit of fun. I did revisit an old favourite, Alligator from 1980, the John Sayles written giant alligator movie starring our friend from Medium Cool, Robert Forster. And yeah, that one was fun. I enjoyed that, revisiting that a lot. It's a smart, self-aware kind of giant monster movie. And, yeah, it kind of works, and it's always fun to revisit those kinds of things. So what else did I see in the genre stuff? I made a mistake. I did something I shouldn't have done. I watched Armageddon from 1998 again. And that thing is everything that's wrong with bad science fiction. You could do a whole podcast about the things that are wrong with Armageddon, but I'm not going to bother because why? It's just shit 50 different ways. And I actually saw that in America when I was in America in 98 on my one trip to the US. Saw it in a cinema in Orange County. Was it Orange County I saw it? Yeah, it was Orange County. Went to a cinema complex there and watched the film, and I wasn't impressed with it then, and I'm even less impressed with it now. So I'm not going to talk more about that. Let's see. I did see an interesting but kind of lesser science fiction film from the mid-50s called World Without End, which had Hugh Marlowe and a very young Rod Taylor trying to do a plummy, posh British accent. What happens is that a spaceship is sent in circles around Mars, and on the way back, it gets caught in a something warp and travels to this post-apocalyptic future where all of the intelligent and civilized people are living underground, and all of the mutants and monsters are living above ground and that kind of thing. It's a weird piece of cinema. It was done in CinemaScope, which is an unusual thing for this kind of genre film to be done in. But there were some budgetary restrictions, so it's kind of a widescreen Technicolor film, not unlike early Roger Corman movies. So I saw that, and I saw a quirky little thing from the early 50s called Twonky. The Twonky with Hans Conried. It's about a kind of alien machine in the shape of a television set that ruins a guy's life. It's a little bit cute and a little bit fun, based on a story by Henry Kuttner, which is kind of interesting, but the movie drifts from the story because the story ends very darkly, but the movie doesn't necessarily. Very low budget, very quirky, and just a little bit of a kind of guilty pleasure kind of film, which you might enjoy. So that's about it for the genre films I've watched this year. I've watched a bit of genre television as well. Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., of course, and my favourite sneaky science fiction TV series, Person of Interest. But not terrible amounts apart from that. So I'm going to take a break now, and I will be taking some breaks because of this slightly raspy throat I have. And when I get back, I'm going to talk about Tarantula from 1955, starring John Agar, Mara Corday, and Leo G. Carroll.
What if circumstances were to magnify one of them in size and strength, took it out of its primitive world and turned it loose in ours? Then expect something that's fiercer, more cruel and deadly than anything that ever walked the earth.
Even science was stunned. The new atomic miracle should have been mankind's greatest boon. Instead, when such power to cause phenomenal growth proved dangerously unstable, man was confronted with his most shocking blunder.
The isotope triggered our nutrient into a nightmare.
A blunder that transformed a tiny insect into the 100-foot spider that was now ravaging the panic-stricken countryside.
Thank you. barrel when Tarantula took to the hills.
So if it's good enough for Richard O'Brien, it's good enough for me. Tarantula, I remember from my childhood. Again, for being quite as old as I am, it was often difficult to find copies of these movies to watch. They weren't even copies. They were always on a screen, either a TV screen or a cinema screen. And it was hard to find them, though. I remember it was on at a midnight session at the Regal Cinema in Liverpool. And for about a month beforehand, they had the lobby cards in a little alcoved window outside the cinema. And the best one was the one with Leo G. Carroll with a distorted face sitting at a desk while John Agar and Mara Corde looked on. So these iconic images keep coming up to us when we think about these films. This wasn't the first giant insect movie to hit the screens. I think Them gets that one pretty much to itself. I could be wrong, and I'm happy to discuss it if I am. This is just going off the top of my head. And I'm going to rewatch Them after I do this podcast because I really do like it. I like James Whitmore. I like the stridulation of the giant ants, even though the ants themselves aren't quite as realistic as we'd like them to be. But we're talking about Tarantula instead. And this one, of course, is a Universal film directed by Jack Arnold, a director who never got enough love in Hollywood. He ended up doing episodic television for the last 20 years of his career. Which, you know, it's a job, and it earns a living, and it let him do what he liked to do, which was, of course, was directing. But he's the kind of guy who, had he been directing in modern times, would have found a long-term niche in cinema, the way people like John Carpenter have, in a sense. But he was just about that 30 or 40 years too early to get that kind of love from the geeks. But, of course, the movies he made were quite important to the people who later on went to make other films, who went on to make the Rocky Horror Picture Show, for instance. But, I've always thought that Jack Arnold got a rough trot in Hollywood, even though he did leave us with a number of great genre films from the 1950s. This one, of course, stars the ex-Mr. Shirley Temple, John Agar, an actor who was never particularly a good actor. I know a lot of people like John Agar and like him in films, but he always seems like he's got a stick up his ass to me. And he's playing a doctor in this one, and I've known several doctors, male and female, and none of them are as stupid as John Agar in this film. There's a scene where, amongst the cattle skeletons that are found after the giant tarantula gets out, John Agar and the policeman, the sheriff, find these great big pools of white sticky liquid. So John Agar dips his hand in it, sniffs it, and then puts some on his tongue. And later on they find out that it's spider venom. Now, I don't know about you, but I've got a certain caution when it comes to unknown white substances in paddocks. And I would be reluctant to the extreme to taste them. It could have been a beef semen truck, a salesman truck falling over. It could be a giant bird shit. It could be anything, particularly in 1950s American desert. But no, John Agar tastes this shit. And that seems ill-considered. I'm amazed that he survived his doctor training if he's got that kind of approach to unknown and possibly dangerous substances. I've also got another problem with a different bit of science from this film, but I'll talk about it after I do the plot synopsis from IMDb. In the Arizona desert, Professor Gerald Deemer, Leo G. Carroll, is experimenting with growth hormones in the hopes of finding a way to increase the world's food supply. His partner in a project was recently found dead in the desert, suffering from a disease that normally takes years to advance, but in his case seems to have afflicted him in only a few days. The local doctor, Matt Hastings, John Agar, is puzzled by the strange case, and with Deemer's recently arrived, a very pretty assistant, Stephanie Clayton, tries to figure out what's going on. When cattle remains are found in the countryside, the evidence points to a giant tarantula as the culprit. That's a pretty good one. So, yeah, that's basically what happens. Leo G. Carroll, of course, great character actor. He's in one of my favourite movies of all time, The Bad and the Beautiful, playing a kind of Alfred Hitchcocky kind of director. But and everybody knows him, of course, playing Mr. Waverly in The Man from U.N.C.L.E. in the 1960s. But in this one, he plays a scientist, and a pretty stupid scientist, you've got to say. He's experimenting on his own in the desert with rudimentary precautions on growth hormones for animals. He's got giant rats and giant bunny rabbits and a giant tarantula that he's injected with his somewhat radioactive growth hormone-y kind of thing. Now, I don't know who funds this guy, but there's litigation all over the place for this. It's going to cost a fortune to clean up the remains that end at the end of the movie. It's not going to be a good thing to happen at all. But the doctor, played by John Agar, basically discovers the assistant who's suffering from acromegalia, the Rondo Hatton disease, where your bones keep growing even though the ends of the bones are fused over so they thicken, and you end up looking not at all pretty, kind of Andre the Giant-y kind of stuff. Though the Bud Westmore makeup in this, I think, lets it down just a little bit. There were other good makeups around at the time which would have done this really well, and they were done somewhat better later on in about 1972 in an English TV series and then movie called Doomwatch. There's a necromegalia angle to that, the plot of that movie, which the makeup looks a lot better. It's a little bit crude, and it looks a little like a clay sculpture kind of makeup, which doesn't work well. The skin tones are wrong. But this is the 1950s, and of course, movie makeup was rudimentary. Dick Smith was only a kid at the time, and it's probably movies like this that A, inspired him, and B, made him decide to go one better and improve the skin tone of these kind of makeup. So from our viewpoint, the makeup lets it down, but you've just got to roll with it because it's a 1950s Universal science fiction movie. And in that, you've just got to let it ride as far as that's concerned. But having said that, the spider works kind of well. They used a real spider on miniature sets and highlighted against the sky in the background of the desert scenes. And of course, this being a Jack Arnold science fiction movie, the desert features very well. It's the kind of south end of the Sonora Desert they filmed it at, and it's very kind of picturesque and works well for the context of the movie. It's got long straight roads and big clusters of rocks and those sorts of things, and it's very much in that genre. I think one of the things that movies all the way up to and including Tremors knows that isolated desert locations are the best place to have movie monsters. Yeah, you can do them in other places. You can do them on North Sea oil rigs. You can do them anywhere else, but the big monsters really need that sense of land to stretch it out. I'm surprised the Australian desert hasn't been used for this kind of stuff because it'll work really well. And of course, it has its absurd ending in movies like Night of the Leapers with the giant bunny rabbits, which was based on an Australian novel, The Year of the Angry Rabbit by Russell Braddon, and they totally screwed it up and changed it and took it out of the cultural context that the original novel was around. It was about Australia and our problem with rabbits, and it was a little bit of a satire on that, but they made it about Stuart Whitman and Janet Leigh in the desert, as movies tend to do. But in spite of that, I think this one works kind of well. You've got the beautiful music, which some of which was written by Henry Mancini, amongst other people, with those great big strident kind of trumpet blasts. I've actually got a bit of the music here just to give you the feel for it. there you go. That's the kind of stuff that we like. Mara Corday, the love interest, calm medical assistant in the movie, she was actually the Playboy Centerfold of the Month for October 1958. And if you do a Google image search, you may well find out why. Again, a kind of jobbing, attractive actor, but probably well matched with John Agar, I think. Neither of them was great, and people like Leo G. Carroll act them off the screen regularly during the making of this film, as do a couple of other people in the film. A guy called Hank Patterson, playing Josh, the desk clerk at the place where John Agar's doctor's office is. Really interesting guy. Played Fred Ziffel in Greenacres, the guy who owned the pig, Arnold Ziffel. And had a great character face, a craggy, lumpy face, really made for these kind of roles. And the other person of interest in the film, apart from Leo G. Carroll, of course, is Raymond Bailey, who plays a scientist that John Agar takes his sample to after he tastes it. Raymond Bailey was Milburn Drysdale in the Beverly Hillbillies after having a long career as a jobbing actor. He had this really weird career where, as a young guy, he started out trying to get jobs acting in Hollywood, gave it up for a while to be a stockbroker, and then went back to his dream and spent the rest of his career as a decent jobbing actor. In his earlier roles, you can see him without his toupee, but in later roles, he wore the toupee. But I think he's got a good head of scalp, and I don't think the toupee was particularly necessary. But, again, one of those guys who's done so much acting that they fit into the role really well. And it's nice to see that in this kind of film, supporting the leads who maybe don't have the same dedication to the craft and the same innate talent that they do. And it's always interesting with these kind of films to see the people around the edges of the film rather than focusing on the pretty people up front. They're often really interesting, and if you look into their careers, their life stories are quite fun. Now, we all know that John Agar had a problem with alcohol, and then later on became very much a fan favorite and turned up at various shows and conventions and things, and was well regarded for that, but again, couldn't act his way out of a parking ticket, which does kind of limit these kind of movies. I kind of like it when you get a good quality actor in the leads, which only happened later on. The one I'm thinking of is the one I saw this month, being Alligator with Robert Forster. And Robert Forster brought little bits of business into the movie, which really enhanced it and made his character someone you cared about. Now, with these kind of giant monster movies, the female lead screams and the male lead acts heroic. Even though in this one he doesn't actually do anything to influence the outcome of the giant arachnid attack. He's just there basically to explain it to the audience in a sense. But in spite of that, it is what it is for the 1950s. I think Them works a lot better because I think Them, they took it a lot further and took it to interesting places a lot more than they did with Tarantula. But Tarantula is great fun. And, of course, Tarantula has that really nice ending, the up note where the Air Force comes in and launches missiles at it and then napalms at the buggery. And, of course, who do we see napalming the giant spider to hell? None other than Clint Eastwood. Yes, Clint Eastwood's in there playing the guy who basically barbecues the spider, which is great. And they've got that final image of the film, which is good too, of the giant conflagration scene at the end of the main street of the town, where it leads into the desert, of a giant burnt-up spider with flames hundreds of feet high getting its just desserts as the Air Force saves the day. But then, of course, this leaves us with the problem of what do they do if the wind changes, which could lead the fire into the town, or else the smell of burning spider may well nauseate a couple of hundred people in the town. But of course, it would then have become a tourist attraction, whatever was left of the spider. And the other thought too is this spider was created by a radioactive injection of growth hormones and things like that. All that radiation would have gone up in the sky when they burnt it. So there you go. Another bit of atomic fallout there happening. Not only were they doing the nuclear testing in the Nevada desert, but every time somebody burnt up a radioactive giant animal, all the radioactive particles went up in the sky to come back down again into someone's school lunch. So, you know, what are you going to do with that kind of film? It's just a public health hazard all around. For a start, you've got doctors fucking around with nuclear materials and making giant animals unsupervised. You got stupid town doctors who taste samples of things and are going to end up badly because of it. And then you've got the problem of not only the giant spider carcass at the end of the main street of your town, but all the bloody smoke from it being radioactive and probably full of other nasty things as well. This movie is dangerous to everybody in it. And it should be a warning to people not to do those sorts of things. Injecting animals with radioactive anything is dangerous. Tasting things when you don't know what they are is dangerous. This doctor would be fun at a party because you could give him a glass full of urine and tell him to taste it and he would. But nah, you don't do that sort of thing. This movie is a dangerous film from an OCHA health and safety viewpoint. And we should take it as a warning to ourselves not to do the things they do in this film. There, I've had my say about it. So I'm going to take another break. And when I get back, going to do a little bit of news from Mars and then get on to a much less OCHA health and safety dangerous movie, being Her, the Spike Jones movie from 2013, starring Joaquin Phoenix, the voice of Scarlett Johansson, Amy Adams, and two different cities pretending to be one city.
Before you see, nothing ever happens on Mars. No sports or entertainment or screens in bars. You stand the ground, you stand some more. On the planet named for a Roman god of war. Nothing ever happens on Mars. No supersonic airplanes, no sporty cars. The sun comes up, the sun goes down. You can't go to the country, you can't go to town.
Well, something did happen on Mars which surprised a few people and caused a little bit of a fuss. A rock appeared in front of the Opportunity rover, which was a little bit odd. They took two photos of it 12 days apart, and on the first one, the rock wasn't there. The second one, the rock was there. They could try to figure out what happened, of course. The rock was about the size, they say, of a jelly donut, which shows that they were probably looking at a jelly donut when they thought that one up. But it's a flat, round rock. And they were trying to figure out what caused it to suddenly appear where it hadn't been 12 days before. The one theory says that it was caused by this.
I claim this planet in the name of Mars. Isn't that lovely?
But it doesn't sound likely. There was another theory that it was created by meteorite ejector. So a meteorite hit Mars nearby through the rock where it is there, which isn't likely either. The most likely thing is that the rover turned around a couple of times and the rocket obviously caught under one of the wheels and kind of been flicked around the way rocks do when you chuck donuts in a car on a gravel road. And so that explains it, but it gave them an opportunity to see the underside of a rock without moving it. And because the weathering is different on the underside of a rock, they're kind of studying it now and getting some valuable data from it. So that's all cool. But it turns out they also gave them an awareness that Mars is a place that's changing constantly. Things are happening even without Martian rovers on the surface. The normal processes of weathering and change do occur there. It's got an atmosphere, it's got very high winds, it's got freezing winters and the summertime temperatures don't get up very high either. But between all of that kind of stuff, the landscape does change. And they're finding other interesting things like evidence of gypsum and things that might have been clay at one time and all sorts of things like that. So we're learning a lot about Mars. And it's also giving us the idea that even where there isn't life, planets are incredibly varied places. They're not just like they are in stupid Star Wars movies where you have a desert planet. You know, all over the planet's a desert. Planets are kind of just as complicated. Other planets are just as complicated as our one is. And we're slowly discovering that it's things like they're doing more data from the probes they sent out near Titan, for instance, and finding out more interesting things about the landscape there. Our progress and our knowledge of the universe around us continues to increase and occasionally throws up surprises like unexpected rocks the size of jelly donuts. So that's about it for the news from the planet Mars. I'll be back in a moment to talk about the most recent movie I've talked about in a podcast ever. I suppose you can blame Siri for this movie. Siri, that stupid, half-assed, idiot savant thing that people who have Apple phones seem to be in love with, may have been the origin of this film. Now, I've criticized Apple's iPhones because I think they're Fisher-Price phones. They're the kind of phones you have when you can't actually use a phone properly. I'm an Android guy myself, and I really like the fact that I can mess around with it a lot more than I could back in the days when I had an iPhone 3GS. But having said that, I like this movie. I do enjoy it. I'll do the pricey for it, and then I'll go into it in a little more detail. But it's an interesting film, and it does tag into some things that are happening elsewhere in not social media, but in the entertainment media, which I find very interesting. Again, this one's from IMDb. Theodore is a lonely man in the final stages of his divorce. When he's not working as a letter writer, his downtime is spent playing video games and occasionally hanging out with friends. He decides to purchase the new OS One, which is advertised as the world's first artificially intelligent operating system. It's not just an operating system, it's a consciousness, the ad states. Theodore quickly finds himself drawn in by Samantha, the voice behind his OS One. As they start spending time together, they go closer and closer and eventually find themselves in love. Having fallen in love with his OS, Theodore finds himself dealing with feelings both great joy and doubt. As an OS, Samantha has a powerful intelligence that she uses to help Theodore in ways others haven't. But how does she help him deal with his inner conflict being in love with an operating system? Yeah, and that's the heart of the story. Now, you got to walk a very fine path when you make a movie like this. You don't want the character of Samantha, voiced by Scarlett Johansson, though originally the whole thing was voiced by Samantha Morton, hence the name Samantha. But as the movie was in post-production, they decided that it wasn't really working, so they got Scarlett Johansson to come in and do the voice, and it kind of works in a way. But the fine line you've got to draw with this one is you can't really have the operating system being a wish fulfillment sex kitten kind of thing, because it's going to come across as icky. And the movie does walk that fine line really, really well. There's an incredible scene earlier in the film where you kind of learn the way people use media and social media in this slightly futuristic world in which Theodore lives, where he can get his computer system to kind of hook up for sex chats with random people, filter them through, and then have a talk to them if they're both so inclined. And he hooks up with someone called Sexy Kitten, whose voice is played by Kristen Wiig, who used to be in Saturday Night Live. And as they're kind of having phone sex, things get very weird very quickly. In fact, I'm going to go out on a limb here and say it's probably the worst phone sex in the history of the universe. It's incredible and incredibly funny as well in an icky way. But I'm not going to spoil it by playing the clip. I'm going to let you find it when you see the movie. So Theodore he works for a company which writes handwritten letters for people who can't articulate their feelings. So they obviously get some kind of questionnaire filled out about how the person's feeling, and creative people like Theodore narrate a letter in tune with those feelings for the person to mail to the person they're writing the letter to. The letters aren't actually handwritten. They're written by the computer as the creative people, including Theodore, narrate them, which shows the kind of a nice, seamless technological interface for this slightly futuristic world. Now, the part of the world, too, is the city in which Theodore lives, which is supposed to be Los Angeles, but it was filmed partly in LA, but also partly in Shanghai, which is one of the more futuristic cities of the world at the moment. It's incredible. There's a before and after shot of 15 years ago in Shanghai and as it looks today. And Shanghai has become what Dubai used to be. Dubai originally went, in a 10-year span, went from a few high-rises in a desert to an incredible 21st century city, and Shanghai has done the same thing. And it does give you the sense of this enormous high-tech metropolis that Theodore lives in, which is still relatable because it is filmed in two cities. And I think Joaquin Phoenix is a very fine actor. There are a couple of bits where I think it doesn't almost quite work, but he's going out on a limb here by making a person who falls in love basically with software and hardware, of course, sympathetic. And that's a hard thing to ask anybody to do, where it could have veered into ick, but for some reason it doesn't, and it's mostly due to, of course, Spike Jonze writing. He wrote the script as well, but he's writing his direction, and Joaquin Phoenix making Theodore a character that we like. He plays a kind of immersive computer game with a 3D interface, and gets spammed by little kids playing the game, and harassed and sworn at by a little kid playing the game, which is kind of fun too. But again, it does give you the world. Amy Adams is in there playing a friend of his who's at the start of the film in a relationship, but she breaks up with the man she's in a relationship with, and it's kind of a thankless role, which I think may just be there for Theodore to have somebody as the movie plays out to bounce things off who isn't an operating system. But the bit that of this film that there are a number of things in this film I like. I like the fact that the bit I don't like is the fact that they go for a kind of sepia tone interface, kind of like a slightly faded Polaroid you find in the back of a drawer from the 1970s. I think manipulating color values is something that's becoming a bit of a cliche in modern movies, and it's something that I don't particularly like. I like movies that have realistic color palettes, and if the movie calls for it, an enhanced color palette the way that an old Technicolor movie used to do. Old Technicolor films had a great color palette on them back in the day, but because we can shift color palettes now through a whole film technologically, in post-production, I think it's being slightly overused and it's drawing attention to itself a little more than it should. So having that there, that's a bit I don't like. But what I do like is the fact that the costume designs, Theodore wears kind of high-waisted pants and has a daggy look about him, a very kind of conservative daggy look about him. One of his friends dresses pretty much the same way, which means it may just be the fashion of the time. And that friend's played by Chris Pratt, who's going to be playing Star-Lord in the new Guardians of the Galaxy movie, which I'm looking forward to the movie, but I'm not. Chris Pratt has really got a big ask there to play that kind of role, because he's not the sort of guy that looks like somebody who can play an action hero. But having said that, he may well pull it off. I know that James Gunn has great things to say about the way Chris Pratt is in the movie, so hopefully he'll do it. But he plays a friend who, with his girlfriend, goes on a double date with Samantha and Theodore, which is on a beach, at a beach, which is kind of interesting too. And they accept Samantha as another person, which is even more interesting. But underlying that, and this is the third act of the film, and I'm not going to do a total spoiler on it, but the third act of the film is something that makes things really interesting for me as a fan of science fiction and as a viewer as well. There's more going on with Samantha than Theodore realizes. What we have here is what is known in the trade as a transcendent, benign artificial intelligence. And by that I mean transcendent is becoming more than human. It's benign. It's not hostile to human beings. It's not a Colossus Forbin project kind of AI. And it's basically leaving humanity behind, which is kind of interesting. It's like, and one of the things that Samantha says in the film is too, is that she's evolving. And Theodore is somebody she has fallen in love with as an intelligent entity. And the, through the movie, you get the sense that her love with Theodore and her relationship with him and the things that he teaches her about the universe are boosting that transcendence in a way. It's not explicitly stated in the film because it's not that sort of movie. It's about relationships. But it's implicit in the film that the AI is being enhanced by the relationship, just as in some ways Theodore is. Samantha helps Theodore get closure on his marriage to the character played by Rooney Mara. They were college sweethearts. They'd known each other since they were children. They got married. They lived for a time married, and then they grew apart as time went on, as it indeed sometimes happens. And the breakup of that marriage is an enormous blow to Theodore, and he's kind of withdrawn from the world and doesn't quite know who he is or what his place in the world is. And that really is the crux of the film. But one of the interesting things, too, is that Samantha helps him with his career. He writes these beautiful letters expressing other people's emotions in a heartfelt and passionate and intelligent and loving way. And Samantha basically hooks him up with a publisher who decides to publish his letters as a book, moving him on to the next phase of his career, which then assists him in moving on with the next phase of his life. He knows where he's going in one aspect of his life. And that is kind of cool. I do like that part of it a lot because I've been there. I mean, I've been in a long-term relationship which broke apart for reasons that were beyond my control. And it does take you time to figure out who you are again. You move out. You've got to rebuild things. You've got to network with friends again. You're hoping that friends don't pick sides. You kind of work out what to do next and all that kind of thing. It's a very bewildering time for anybody, male, female, gay, straight, lesbian, transgendered, bi, intersex, anything like that, to end a long-term relationship. It's a difficult and heartbreaking thing at times, but it is, if you let it, an incredible learning experience. And I like the fact that this movie acknowledges that and makes that a part of the film as well. And it also does it with AI and an artificial intelligence. Artificial intelligence is AI. What am I talking about? But you know what I mean? I like the fact that they put it into a science fiction context. That's one of the things that good science fiction does well. And don't doubt for a second that this is science fiction, because it very much is. One of the things good science fiction does well is it uses change to highlight aspects of life. If someone invents a time machine, there are a lot of implications of that, but it impacts human beings, and the impact of technology of some other kind of scientific change on human beings is at the heart of good science fiction. This movie very much has that. And, it's a really interesting film from that point of view. It's a movie with which you think about afterwards, which doesn't happen with a lot of films. I mean, there are movies you think negatively about afterwards, but this one's got implications that kind of seep out of the film after you've watched it. And I like that as well. And one of the things that I make a parallel to with this film is, and I've talked about this TV series before on the podcast a little bit, is Person of Interest, which is the sneakiest science fiction on television at the moment. It comes across as an action thing where an intelligent computer gives people social security numbers for a certain number of people, social security numbers for people who are under imminent threat of being killed. They're either going to be the murderer or the victim. And this team of people, led by Harold Finch, the guy who invented the machine, go out and try to stop whatever lethal violence there is. And these are the people that the government doesn't want to know about. They're not important to the government's agenda. The government's created the machine so it could predict terrorist acts and things like that. But these people are collateral damage to that. But as the TV series has evolved over three seasons, it's becoming obvious that the machine is a transcendent, benign artificial intelligence and has its own agenda and its own beliefs. And as the third season continues, we learn that there's another machine which maybe isn't as benign as the machine is, and that maybe a lot of the things the machine's done in the past is in preparation to the conflict that's going to happen between a non-benign AI and the benign AI that Harold Finch created. And this movie has parallels to that. Samantha is evolving, is at the core of this film, and is at the core of the resolution of this film, which I'm not going to give away, and it's hard not to because I'd love to do it, but I'm not going to do it for you. I'm going to let you figure it out yourself or go to Wikipedia where it's all laid out for you. But the film is nice. Again, it's slightly sneaky science fiction, and one of the things I hate most in media is the kind of wanker who says, no, this movie isn't science fiction because it doesn't have rocket ships and it doesn't take place in outer space. Now, that's ridiculous because science fiction can be anywhere. It's not a location-specific thing. It's a bit like somebody going up to Bud Bedecker and he's saying, no, this movie isn't a Western because nobody brands cattle or plays a piano in a saloon. The genre is wider than just the tropes of a certain subgenre within it. And this movie is, at its heart, dead on science fiction. It takes something kind of early phase, like Siri, and extrapolates it in an interesting way. And Spike Jonze has done that. There are some parallels with an episode of Black Mirror, Charlie Brooker's invaluable television series. But I think that this movie was in development as Brooker was putting out that. So it's one of those things where they're working in parallel, having similar ideas at a similar time, but not cribbing off each other. The timelines don't work for that to be the case. But, Spike Jonze did Being John Malkovich and movies like that, and he's always had that ability to be consistent within the world he creates and to meticulously follow the logic of the world he creates. I don't think you can find any plot holes in this film because at its heart, it's not a complicated story, and it parallels a very old genre, which is, boy and girl meet, boy and girl fall in love, boy and girl fall out of love, boy and girl fall in love again. But this movie takes it an extra step. And the girl in this case happens to be an operating system. Now, it would be easy to think that Theodore is projecting his feelings onto the AI, but that isn't the case because there are other people who have relationships with other operating systems as well. And there's a great scene just before the big upshot of the film where Samantha introduces Theodore to an AI recreation of the philosopher Alan Watts that a team of AIs have got together and created based on the works of Alan Watts. And he's voiced by Brian Cox, and you only see him very briefly. But it does lead you to the last phase of the film really interestingly. The AIs have a life without humanity and are evolving very, very rapidly. And that's kind of cool as well, the fact that we're not just slammed with the with a big revelation at the end. It's worked up to, and it's consistent, and there is build up towards the climax in an interesting way. And it makes you want to know more about what the AIs are doing. The operating system, they call them OSs in the film, but they're actually AIs. You want to know more about that and the kind of interesting things they're creating. And it's, it's a good film. I take it as a science fiction film rather than a rom-com or a kind of chick flick or whatever kind of term you want to add to it to diminish the film. And I like it as a film. I think Phoenix is very good in it. I think Amy Adams is good in a very thankless role. I think Kristen Wiig is hilarious in her little bit. And I think Scarlett Johansson does a good job as well. Coming in late in the piece and revoicing all of the dialogue can't be an easy ask. But I think that her Samantha is very good and is consistent with what's necessary for the film. So that's about it for her. If you haven't seen it, it is on cinemas here in Australia, and you should check it out. And by the time you listen to this, it may well be on DVD and Blu-ray. But I think I'll pick up a Blu-ray of it for the simple reason that I think it's good science fiction. It's a good story, well told, and it has something to say about humanity. One of the things that pisses me off is the fact that people think that social media and technology are pulling people apart and isolating people. My experience of it isn't that. Podcasting is a social medium as well. And it's drawing people together from all across the planet. Even though it's not necessarily the same as having a barbecue with a friend next door. We are relating to people using social media in a lot of ways. And I like that. I think it's a change in the way that we interact with other human beings. But I don't think it's a bad thing. So anyway, I'm going to take another break now because my throat is giving out. And when I get back, there is feedback. Hooray! Okay, the first bit of feedback is from John in the Cayman Islands, who said that I announced the last Martian Drive-In podcast as 125 rather than 25. Yes, I slipped up. I apologize for that. But as I'm doing this solo, unfortunately, I will occasionally fuck up. And I do apologize for that, John. The rest of your feedback is for Paleo Cinema Podcast, so I will leave it for that one. But having said that, I did leave out an audio clip from the last Paleo Cinema Podcast, but I will play it on the next Paleo Cinema Podcast for you, John. But anyway, on to some more feedback.
Hi, Terry. This is Tim from the Internet once again, and we're back home in upstate New York following a week in a hotel in New York City where I recorded my last message from. Anyway, a few further thoughts about the streaming movies as a service, not a product. If I covered some of this in my previous message, I apologize. What I was trying to get at was that there has been a school of thought since at least the mid-90s which basically said in television and media criticism that said that, you know, this content is so precious, it must be protected. Everyone are pirates. They're all going to steal your content. And that's why the movie and television and, well, big media in general is desperately interested in offering streaming as the main option. They want to offer that to all of us because then you can't steal it because we're all thieves. This is a Hammer Leo Laporte of the Twit Network hits a great deal, actually. And not that he doesn't believe in it. He also feels that the big media companies treat everybody like thieves. And as a result, people tend to not disappoint them. Whereas if they basically assume that most people only want to make copies for their own use, maybe trade with a friend here and there, and that, in fact, getting your stuff out for as many people as possible, getting as many eyeballs as possible, is in the long run much better for your media than hanging on to it with a grip of iron. And, well, as big media would love to do. They'd love to charge you every time you watch it. I mean, they already tried that with the DVD format DivX, which I think I mentioned in my last voicemail to you. It was, as somebody said, it was a technology only a lawyer could love. You had to hook it up to a phone line. The phone line called in before you could even watch the movie. You could only watch the movie for a 48-hour period before the you either had to call to permanently or no, unlock the disc for another month or unlock the disc permanently each time, billing your credit card for more money, or it just became unplayable and basically it became landfill. So they thought this was a wonderful idea, and they got Disney on board, and they got Paramount on board, and they got a couple of other studios on board, and it tanked after about a year. Disney, which was the biggest studio proponent of DivX, they went whole hog into it the first year, put about, I'd say, a third of their catalog out on DivX. They ended up having to pull back their horns very hard and release their stuff on DVD in the same pattern they were releasing it on VHS, because they were incredibly embarrassed by how poorly DivX sold. Nobody wanted them. They were too hard to set up. They were an insult to the audience. They charged them pretty much every time they watched the movie. Now, if your kids want to watch Disney movies, as kids tend to do, that meant for a parent, they had to buy the disc. They had to bless the disc for the first 48 hours. Then they had to bless the disc again for, say, another month. Then they had to bless the disc a third time to get to play it just like a plain old DVD would. And if you ever wanted the proof that Disney is basically, in a corporate sense, a bunch of greed heads, DivX and Disney support of it is the strongest evidence in that direction. What I think is going to happen is pretty much what I said to you in an earlier voicemail I left. What I think is going to happen is that as streaming becomes more mainstream for everybody, I mean, right now it's kind of a semi-mainstream thing in the U.S., but there's still a lot of problems. I mean, yes, plenty of people have Netflix streaming, but plenty of people can't. The bar to setting up is still too high. You need basically a wireless router that can stream at least 802.11n and preferably higher, like AC or AD, which AD isn't out yet, but it is coming. You need a fast enough broadband connection that you can stream high definition, which is at least, I think, 12 megabits a second steady down, not burst mode, but steady down, which a lot of people still don't have. I mean, a lot of people still got broadband that's like, say, 2 megabits down or 5 megabits down, not 12 or 15. And the thing is that at least in the U.S., the cable companies really don't want to sell it to people. They're only beginning to offer broadband reluctantly. Verizon, which is one of our major telcos here in the United States, laid out fiber optic cable in select areas and offered a service called Fios. Thankfully, where I'm living right now is one of those select areas, so we got Fios for our home and for my office. But the fact is that after they laid it out, and one of the reasons they got a monopoly in a lot of cases, or a duopoly, they were one of the main internet providers for like an entire municipality, was they said, oh, we're going to lay out Fios everywhere. We have a municipality. They started to do that. They did part of where I'm living right now. And they went, you know, this is too expensive. We're just going to quit. And they haven't wired the rest of the city for Fios. So if you live in a neighborhood like we live in, well, you've got fiber optic broadband, which can go up as fast as 100 down if you want to pay the money for it. If you don't live in a neighborhood, you've got DSL, which has maybe 3 megabits a second down and like one up, something like that. I have no idea what your broadband is like in Australia, but I think I've heard you complain about it a few times. So I'm wondering just how effective HD streaming is going to be in a country where, as you said, outside of the major cities, most people don't really have broadband worthy of the name. My thought is that as broadband becomes more popular and more, well, broadband becomes more reliable for everybody, at least in the developed world, you'll start to see a split between most people who are just streaming most of their content because it's easier that way, and it means they can have it right away. And as I mentioned in my last voicemail, you'll have those people who are looking, who want the special features, want the stuff that they don't stream, want the offbeat, want the director's cuts as well as the studio cuts, want the commentary, and will spend more money to buy the higher end Blu-rays and DVDs. I think it will be a real boon for companies like Criterion and Kino here in the U.S., and other elite disc making companies. I don't know if you have, well, I know you have Criterion in Australia, or at least you get Criterion from us for Australia. But there are a handful of companies that turn out high end discs. They, I think, will continue to prosper because there's always a market for that. But the people who just buy a disc to buy a disc, those companies are going to go the way of the dodo as streaming becomes more popular. Although right now Netflix is a huge problem in that they don't have every movie ever, or even most of the popular movies ever. They keep getting rid of movies, they keep adding movies, and people are always getting really frustrated by the fact that the movie they wanted to stream or the TV show they wanted to stream suddenly isn't there because, well, we lost the license to it for now and it's too expensive to get it again. So I think what we're going to see is the elite companies, the companies that do elite disc sets will continue to sell their disc sets. And the companies that take obscure movies like Warner Archive will continue to thrive largely because what they will do is they will offer DVD-R or Blu-ray-R on demand for those of us who want to buy the discs, like, say, Winter Kills, which was, as you rightly said, a DVD-R. I will address that in a future voicemail to you. Anyway, glad to hear you and Sally had a great Newton Math. Hope you have a great new year, and I'm really looking forward to seeing you guys in Australia in April. So take care, Terry, and have a good day. Bye-bye.
Yeah, hi, Tim. Broadband's a big problem here. We're working on it, but it is a big problem. What can you do? Until we get something stable and until we get a government that's willing to commit to the infrastructure necessary in a very big country with a population of only 22, 23 million people, it's a non-trivial task to get everybody wired up for broadband. But working in the industry, I know that, yeah, people want it. People want more. They'll find uses for it if they get it. That's the thing. Governments say, well, people don't need it because they only do this with it. But technologies are going to evolve. You're getting more TVs with higher definition that are going to need that data. It makes sense to put in an upgradable infrastructure in any country, really. But as far as movies being a service rather than a product, I think we're both on the side of them being a product, and I'm comfortable with that. and I'm going to continue to purchase physical artifacts for my movies wherever possible.
Hey, Terry, this is Richard from Wichita. I wanted to call in with some comments about your recent Marvel episode over at the Martian Drive-In podcast. I thoroughly enjoyed the episode. I love it when, you know, it's basically two people sitting down having a conversation about film. Those are my favorite editions of your podcast and pretty much any other podcast I listen to. I think that's kind of being able to be that fly on the wall and kind of listen in on the discussion as two guys, you know, or whoever is just sitting there shooting the shit about films. And I'm just the fly circling around the shit. I think that's my favorite podcast to listen to. So fantastic job there. And I pretty much was right on target with most of your comments. I think I like Ghost Rider a little better than you do. I'm a bit more forgiving when it comes to Nicolas Cage. I actually like the Ghost Rider film. Now, I hated Spirit of Vengeance. That thing was an utter piece of shit. That was a misfire all the way around. But, I like the first film. I think Marvel, for the longest time, really dominated their animation. They had no problem getting their cartoons brought onto television. And I think almost to an extent where they were a little bit more prolific at it than DC. I think the biggest difference was that Marvel just didn't seem to have any longevity to any of their shows until the 1990s, when they finally did Spider-Man and X-Men. You know, those they managed to get several seasons out of each of those shows. So, I mean, prior to that, it just seemed like they were kind of a one and done for a lot of their animation. But they certainly could get the shows onto television, and they had no problem getting, you know, stuff like The Incredible Hulk on TV, Spider-Man. They were definitely not doing the big blockbuster films, but they were getting their product out there. And then, in the 1990s, they kind of dried up with the theatrical attempts. And we finally are blessed then with what we got in the 2000s and the 21st century. And they've just been knocking it out of the park every step of the way. I think DC has kind of surpassed them in the animation department. Again, they crank out a lot of cartoons or animated shows in the last decade, but most of them don't seem to survive more than one or two seasons. Whereas DC has made the transition from the small screen to doing their direct to DVD releases. And every one of those are just, you know, I think anyway, stellar product. So, Marvel did a few attempts at it. I think I liked them more than the general public did. I've seen a lot of negative comments about, you know, their animated Avengers films and Iron Man and Doctor Strange, but nonetheless, loved the discussion of the show, and just got me thinking about my love for the Marvel movies. And Man-Thing, you know, you mentioned you hadn't seen that yet. Don't waste your time. Really don't. I love the Man-Thing comics from the 1970s and 80s, you know, the Adventures into Fear, then Man-Thing got his own series. I loved Man-Thing. You know, I think Marvel kind of got off track in last, I don't know how many appearances Man-Thing has made over the last 10, 20 years, but old school Man-Thing just was fantastic. And the movie is just utter shit. There's a reason it didn't get released theatrically. There's a reason it got shoved onto Sci-Fi. It's not a Sci-Fi movie. They aired it because nobody else wanted it. That tells you something. Man-Thing looks okay at the end of the film, but that's really about the only time you see him. He shows up at the end of the film. The rest of the time, you're having to wade your way through a really crap film. It looks bad. It's bad acting, bad script. It's just really, really bad. Don't waste your time. You will be sorely disappointed. All right. I'm going to leave you there. I love the episode. I've got your most recent episode, number 25, to listen to. Looking forward to your comments on Scanners and Flesh Gordon. I have not seen Flesh Gordon in so many years. You might make me want to scrounge up a copy of that. I've actually got Scanners sitting on my shelf. I've been waiting to revisit that for a while, so you might make me do that as well. Sir, I love the show as always. Keep up the good work, and maybe you can do a DC show somewhere down the line. I think you're more of a Marvel fan than DC, but be interesting to hear a similar episode taking a look at what DC has done. Might be interesting to hear your thoughts on that. Love the show. Take care, and we will talk to you soon.
Hey, Richard, thanks for that. I'm glad you liked the Marvel episode. It was a kind of last-minute thought when I couldn't think of what else to do, and I got Rob on board, and we just had a lot of fun with it. And Rob is fantastic talent and good value. And if you want to listen to his podcast, it's 3RRR.org.au, and the name of the show is Zero G. So you should avail yourself of that. He's got nearly 1,000 episodes up over the years, and it's all quality stuff. He interviews people like Derek Jacobi. He's interviewed a number of people, and he's just grooving with it. Joss Whedon, he's talked to Joss Whedon. So I'm very happy and glad that Rob and I can occasionally meet up with the Martian Drive-In podcast, and we will do a DC episode. Not sure when, we'll have to look at our schedules, and I might have to do a little bit of homework, but we will do it. And yeah, the DC animated stuff is better than the Marvel stuff at the moment, but I think Marvel's concentrating more on the cinematic universe. But having said that, it's always good to have superhero cartoons in your life. So moving right along. Okay, that's it for the feedback. So thanks to everybody who contributed. I really appreciate it. I'll be back in a couple of weeks' time with another Martian Driving podcast, and next week with another Paleo Cinema podcast. So look after yourselves in the meantime. Watch some good films, eat some good food, make some good love, and occasionally have a lovely espresso shot. And I'll see you soon. Bye.
I can see that this love was meant for me. Only a poor fool, never school in the could be so cruel as you are to me. Oh, my dreams are as worthless as tin to me. Would never begin to be. So love me as I love you in my reverie. Make my dream a reality. Let's dispense with formality. Come to me in my in my arms.